It's usually exciting radio when a reform candidate comes on. We all like reform. Fiscal conservative and social conservative Joe Miller is taking another shot at a U.S. Senate seat. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. He's far behind Sullivan and Treadwell in fundraising, but few are counting Joe Miller out. Our phone number statewide and toll-free 1-800-478-8255. 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. You can call right now. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. It's been a few years since Joe Miller was at this microphone, but he's here today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Just weeks away from the primary election, and Joe Miller is in Anchorage and opened his Anchorage campaign headquarters yesterday. Joe Miller, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve. We had a great open house last night. It's actually been open for a little while, but I had a lot of people that came in. Excited to see the grassroots support here in Anchorage.
And?
And also excited to see you, Steve, after several years.
It has been a while. Well, you came in last time, and you basically were on federal spending and too much government. I don't think that message changed that much, right?
Not too much, although the liberty message is a lot stronger now. You know, we didn't have all the knowledge we have today about the surveillance state. We had little snippets of it, but didn't really know the extent, because we've had whistleblowers since the 2010 raise, like Edward Snowden and others, that were intimately involved in the expansion of that government surveillance and control. And from my perspective, that is a major issue. I mean, this is all about liberty. It's all about government basically expanding itself into every nook and cranny of our lives. And it's about who we're going to send to Washington, D.C., who's not going to compromise on the issue of pushing back against the federal government.
All about liberty. Well, Joe Miller, tell me, let's say, I mean, you came pretty close 4 years ago. And I'm sure you'll want to talk about that race. But let's say that the way this race plays out, you end up with the nomination, maybe even the Libertarian nomination, and you knock off Mark Begich, and suddenly you're a U.S. senator. What are the first three things that you would want to accomplish?
Well, I think the number one thing to do is organize with the other liberty-minded people that are in the Senate. And right now we have Ted Cruz and Mike Lee. They're solid. Rand Paul joins on most of the issues. And I think that you have to reestablish and reaffirm that group. Mike Lee and Ted Cruz have done a stand-up job in standing for some of these new liberty-oriented issues. Energy Renaissance Act that has been proposed. Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, both behind it, which would actually take federal land and lease them to the state for production. Major issue. I think in addition to that, that we have to address the spending issues. Admiral Mullen said that the number one issue right now facing the national security of the United States is the national debt. Senator Tom Coburn, who's leaving office, wrote a book called The Debt Bomb, which basically focuses on our debt as being an issue that could basically bend us to some of our foreign competitors' will. He gives the example, tells a story about Taiwan, what would happen if China decided it wanted to take Taiwan, and then said, look, if you Americans interfere, we're going to pull our support for your debt. What would happen to the American economy then? So that's another issue that's going to be addressed. I think we have to stand for life. I'm unequivocally pro-life. In my perspective, that's an issue that, you know, has not been addressed adequately by the Republican Party for the times that it's been in power over the last three decades. For 30 of the last 34 years, Republicans have been in control of the House, the Senate, and or the presidency. And yet abortion still remains basically as accessible as it was 30 years ago. From my perspective, and this is just one of many different issues that Republicans have failed on, that's something that has to be addressed in a very firm and also uncompromising way.
But I mean, essentially, there's a Supreme Court in the way.
There is a Supreme Court that if you – this is – we can talk about the Obamacare decision with John Roberts. You can talk about the very large number of abortion cases that have come to the Supreme Court. It's almost always been Republican Supreme Court justices that have stood in the way. It's not always the Democrats. And I think – and this is part of what I and those on the left kind of stand unified with. When we look at the two parties and what they actually stand for, in the people's eyes, they see these distinct differences. But in reality and action, whether it be on the life issue, government spending, liberty, their surveillance state, they all seem to be singing the same tune, not in the rhetoric, but in the action. And I think this is just one area where when we send people to Washington, D.C., that go along, get along, you obviously are going to have the type of compromise that's brought us to the point of really a lack of any movement at all on important issues.
You ready for some calls?
Sure, you bet.
All right, Joe Miller is our guest, and the telephone number, in case you forgot it, is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. That's statewide, toll-free. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, and email talk at alaskapublic.org. But be aware, if you send a long email message, there's no way I'm going to be able to read it because I'm busy trying to have a conversation here. But Joe Miller's our guest, and our first caller then is Simon from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Joe Miller, Simon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Hi, Simon.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Okay. So my question was, what is your position on climate change in Alaska?
Well, you know, I'm all for it as long as we get warmer in Fairbanks. We have these bumper stickers up in Fairbanks called Fairbanks is for Global Climate Change. We have had the coldest winters since we've been up there. We've lived in the interior now since 1998. We started in Tok, where my wife, who's sitting here in the studio with us, got to suffer through several days of 70 below zero weather. And as we try and struggle to heat our house for our children, we're reminded daily about how cold it actually is in the midst of the winter. You know, I think the science is inconclusive on that, Simon, but even if that weren't the case, I think that what we have to do as a people is a cost-benefit analysis. A lot of times what government does is it will use these red herrings, basically these straw men, if you will, to give excuse to additional government control. And on the climate change agenda, there frankly is an effort of those that want to control your life to use this as just yet one more reason to put more controls down. I think when we make decisions in that area, you have to make sure, number one, on the global climate change issue, that if the science is really out there that it is conclusive, that it's man-made, you then have to say, okay, the solutions that we offer are going to actually address it, that's actually going to result in change. And I think that the third thing is you've got to make sure from a cost-benefit analysis you aren't causing more harm than good. Of course, at the very beginning of it, from the federal government's perspective, is it constitutional? So, I mean, I know that there's reasonable debate on this issue on both sides of it, but from a decision-making point at the federal government level, the constitutionality, whether it's hurting people, are key issues for me.
Well, that's funny that you think it's a joke, but I think I just heard on NPR that they're projecting that climate change is going to cost the country $150 billion a year.
Yeah.
And when you said inconclusive, I can tell you for a fact that the temperatures in Alaska have risen by 3 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 40 years. And what it's going to cost Alaskans is infrastructure costs. And in Fairbanks and everywhere else where there's underlying permafrost that's currently degrading due to the warming temperatures and the extreme swings in temperature, I understand you get a really cold period, but on the reverse end of that, you get a very warm period of weather. And when you have warm period and you have, for example, foundations that are reliant on consistent cold temperatures to keep the ground frozen that your buildings are built on, you're going to see issues. So I personally think it's going to, you know, hit Alaska hard, and especially in areas where we have underlying permafrost, because when you have a ice-rich, silty soil, when it melts, it doesn't hold anything up. It just kind of turns to mud, and then the building that's sitting on it will start to sink into the earth.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments, Simon. No, I didn't mean to intend that I think anything's a joke. I think that the decisions that are made at the federal level are very serious and they have real impacts on real people. And I think that any time that we go around making decisions, first of all, that don't comply with the authority of the federal government by way of the Constitution and that actually hurt people, I mean, every time that we make a decision, there, especially when it comes to you know, what kind of tax we're going to apply, what type of cost we're going to apply to the average everyday person, that has real-world impact. And I think the cost has got to be considered in whatever we do.
I understand that. And you talk about hurting people. I mean, we'll spend $25 million on a missile, and the end result of that missile is ultimately to hurt somebody. But we won't spend, you know, $25 million to come up with a cleaner burning vehicle or, you know, whatever. I mean, you can get a lot for $25 million.
All right. Thank you, Simon. No real disagreement there. Joe Miller is our guest. Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Let's take that military spending. That's the one thing that Congress is always seems to put at the top of the list of things that they'll pay more money for. But the fact of the matter is, if you talk to people who actually work on the bases, they're scared half to death because there are a lot of personnel cuts coming.
Right, and I think that there's a little bit of misunderstanding about defense and expenditures. If you look at the Ryan Murray bill that passed out at the end of last year, you know, that both parties claimed, again, this is an attack from Republicans and Democrats, that they cut the budget. I mean, they're out there just proclaiming success, bipartisan success. The Cato Institute came out, studied it, said, not so fast. You actually spent more money, tens of billions more. But the real egregious fact of that whole Ryan Murray bill was that it cut the retirement pay of people that have served this country for 20 years or more. There was a study that suggested that E7s that had served 20 years would see an $80,000 cut in their retirement. And it was just outrageous. Outrageous. And the people reacted with outrage. And as you probably know, that ended up getting reversed because of the reaction of the people. It does reflect actually a significant positive that sometimes the reaction of the people, when it's nationwide, will actually create a result in Washington, D.C., which is very unusual. Normally, the ruling class in D.C. tells us what they're going to do, and they don't really care about what the people say. But that reflects what happens in these times of budgetary, fiscal uncertainty, a restriction based upon the $17.5 trillion in debt, $200 trillion in future unfunded liabilities. What first gets cut are those things like defense. And look, I'm not a neocon, very much opposed to the way that the wars were carried out in Iraq and Afghanistan. The foreign policy that was given birth through this is an absolute shambles when you look at Libya, when you look at Syria, when you look at what's going on right now in Iraq, when you look at what's happening in Iran, Afghanistan. But I don't think in this time of incredible international uncertainty, you look at what Russia's doing right now in the Crimea, taking on Crimea, what they're doing, currently in the eastern provinces of Ukraine. When you look at what China is doing, the South China Sea, taking on areas in the waters that, you know, historically have been claimed by Vietnam, the Philippines, and other Southeast Asian countries. When you look at what China has done with respect to international airspace and telling the United States that you have to have our permission before you fly through this airspace. This is not a world in which things are getting more peaceful. It's a world in which there are significant pressures being applied against the United States. And in part, it's because of a perspective of weakness. There's a perception from many of these competitors that the United States has passed its nadir, that we're headed downward largely because of the debt. And it's something that we can ill afford, especially if you think that I believe that we're founded to be that bright, shining city on the hill, that we're the example for other nations, the fundamental liberties that our founders enshrined in the Constitution, given by God. Those are things that have created the greatest free enterprise system on the face of the earth. And it's something that if other nations were to follow suit, genuinely follow suit, they could create the same sort of opportunity for them. These other nations like China, Russia, they don't believe in the same things we do. They don't have the same sense of freedom. And I think that we have to be realistic about the environment we're in.
Well, let me ask you before we get to our next question, which is going to go to the minimum wage. which is going to appear on the ballot at the same time as the general election. I wanted to pursue this international affairs a little bit in terms of the Arctic. Our two senators, both Begich and Murkowski, are pushing very hard to get another icebreaker. And they're pulling every lever they can and yanking everybody's chain they can. And I'm just wondering what your position would be on that, as well as like the cooperation. You probably would oppose ratifying the Law of the Sea Treaty, but what would be your proposal for relations with other nations with regards to Arctic issues as all this ice melts out?
Well, if all the ice melts, we don't need our icebreakers, right?
They'll still be around in the wintertime, you know.
That was a joke, by the way.
I know.
No, I mean, it's incredibly important for us to be active in the Arctic. And this is a debate, you know, both of my opponents in the primary have been very, very strong Law of the Sea proponents. My opposition has been well stated and consistent over the years. The Law of the Sea Treaty, which almost was ratified, one vote short, just a couple of years ago when the count was made, would impose an international tax for the first time in the history of the world. And it would also require technology transfers from more industrialized countries to less industrialized countries. It would set up an international seabed authority based in Jamaica, which takes those international taxes and distributes them in a way that they see fit. It's the type of control that this United States does not need. You look at our EPA. A lot of people in this state object to the EPA and its controls it exerts on Alaska. The Law of the Sea Treaty actually creates a super EPA, of course, governed by the United Nations, which has not exactly been the most clean organization. In fact, it's probably one of the most corrupt organizations that we have on the face of the earth. And it's also one of the most inept organizations on the face of the earth. And yet we're giving power to it to not just tax, but also to regulate what we put into the waters, the international waters. There's already been action taking place by countries that have ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty, where the EPA, basically the international EPA, through the Law of the Sea Treaty, has gone in and told a factory in Great Britain, for example, you can't do this, or we're going to basically penalize you for this effluent that you put into a waterway in Great Britain that we then see had some sort of impact on the oceans. It's not something that I think Americans want to do, at least those that love the sovereignty of this country. And I think more importantly, if you really have as your objective, because this is the argument that I've heard in Alaska from Governor Treadwell himself, of course, Mr. Sullivan has a long track record in supporting the Law of the Sea Treaty. Well, we just need to do this because it will open up development opportunities to us here in Alaska. Off the OCS, we will have this regime that we know how we can develop and what our rights are. Well, there's no reason in the Arctic, especially when you're dealing with just a handful of countries, why those things cannot be accomplished by bilateral treaties. I'm all about talking to our neighbors. I'm all about doing things that advantages the American people and increases the resourcefulness and opportunity to Alaskans. It can be done by bilateral treaties. That's how we've always conducted foreign policy in the past. Some would argue that the Law of the Sea Treaty would open up other opportunities, like we'd have free passage on the international waters. Well, that's already established by the historic use of the waters in the world today. And some of these countries that have already adopted the Law of the Sea Treaty, like China, they aren't obeying the dictates of it anyway with respect to free passage. Why is our signatory on the line going to change that at all? So I think there are a lot of reasons why we shouldn't do that. A lot of opportunity in the Arctic that we had to focus on. The icebreakers, as well as the military presence in Alaska, is critical, given our geostrategic importance. I think it was General Billy Mitchell who made the comment that basically Alaska is at the center point for strategic importance in the world. And that was back in the 1930s that he said that. I mean, today, that is even all the more clearer that we sit at a very important position geographically, geostrategically, because of how the world and the shifts of power have occurred over the last couple of decades.
And now down to domestic affairs, an abrupt turn with J.D. in Fairbanks. J.D., you're on the air with Mike Miller. Mark? Excuse me, Joe Miller. been years since Mike was on.
Hello, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Member, Yeah, I'm a member of Labor's Union Local 942 here in Fairbanks, and because I'm going to ask you two questions, and because they're important to my union, I'd really like a straightforward, honest yes or no answer to each one. The first one is, do you support raising the minimum wage? And the second one is, do you support the Davis-Bacon law with union scale as the prevailing wage?
Wow, those are tough questions. And I'm not really sure a yes or no necessarily works, because on the minimum wage, you have a state and a federal side of it. I think the federal government should not have a role on that. I think it's up to the state.
Do you support the initiative on the state ballot this fall?
It's a state issue. It's not a federal issue. It's for the state to decide. I think that generally speaking, let me give you a little bit of background, then I'll give you a straight yes or no on it. But I want to give you a little background first, if you'll just bear with me for a minute. I think that wages are a huge issue, okay? I grew up in a poor family. Even right now, I'm the only non-millionaire that's running for office. I'm not backed by big money. For us, my family, I still have four children at home. We have a budget. My wife sitting here will tell you she has a budget. We have limits on what we can spend and do spend. Since the 1970s, wages in this country have stagnated. The average male worker in the mid-70s making $10 an hour, if you look at his wage today, inflation adjusted, it's about $10.01. In other words, it has been flatlined. But that's only half the story, because that same wage earner is producing about 80% more because of increases in productivity. So, you know, almost producing double the amount, but receiving the same wage. Middle class net worth stagnated. A lot of people see the minimum wage as basically a panacea. If only we up the minimum wage, we'll change that. That's a false story. That's not the answer to it. There are lots of other answers that I think, by focusing on the United States, and instead of outsourcing all of our work, instead of importing green card workers, especially into this state. I mean, it amazes me when my kids go out looking for a job in Fairbanks, which is where we still live, and they go into Home Depot or Lowe's, and half the workforce doesn't even live in Alaska, let alone Fairbanks. And why is that? Because we've incentivized people to come in and basically suppress wages. A lot of people on the left will push back against me on this amnesty issue, but it's proven empirically that illegal aliens depress wages. Anytime that we import labor, whether it be legal or illegal, wages go down. There are lots of different factors that have caused this. I mean, I think in part probably because of the crony capitalist state. When we have decision makers that are making decisions based upon what the corporate interests, especially multinational corporations, tell them to do, the end.
Could you answer yes or no? You're evading the question.
No, I'm just giving you the background that I am very concerned about wages, but the minimum wage, the minimum wage issue is not going to solve those. It's 5% of the population. I believe that the market ought to apply when it comes to wages.
Okay, so you do not support the initiative this fall. You do not support raising the minimum wage.
It's a state issue. The state can decide, but I'm going to vote no on that initiative.
Okay, the second question, what about, do you support the Davis-Bacon law with union scale as the prevailing wage? Straightforward. Come on, Joe. Honest yes or no answer.
I do not.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, JD, thanks for your call from Fairbanks and insisting on an answer. Joe, earlier you brought up, Joe Miller is our guest, the telephone number 1-800-478-8255. He's running for the U.S. Senate, and you brought up about surveillance and the revelations from Snowden, and Patrick says, well, what about Snowden? Do you consider him a hero or a traitor?
You know, I think Snowden was well-intentioned. I think he did what he did because he believed that the Fourth Amendment was being violated. When you see what he's done and the impacts to him personally, there's no real major benefit. I mean, he's left his country of his birth. He's living in a place which I've been to briefly in Moscow, and I can tell you I don't want to live there. So I don't think he did this out of any type of decision to advance his own personal interest. It's not just Snowden, but it's a number of others as well, Steve, that have done the same thing. The guy that allegedly developed the algorithm that allows us to record, or allows the NSA to record cell phone calls, also came public, went public, and against his interest, describe what the U.S. government is doing with respect to the invasion of our privacy. So I think there are a lot of well-intentioned people out there that are trying to let the American people know that their government is growing toward tyranny. And that's really what this is. Angela Merkel made it clear when she commented on the East German Stasi and how they didn't hold a candle to the U.S. government in its ability to survey its people. I mean, think about it. They have
already, she was really mad.
She was. I mean, she didn't like her cell phone conversations being monitored by our security agencies. But the fact is, it's happening all across this country, too. I'm not suggesting there are millions of analysts sitting in the back room listening to all our conversations, although I think for some people in the United States that happens. You know, one of the whistleblowers commented that even then-Senate candidate Barack Obama, a number of years ago, had his communications monitored, claimed that he saw the order that went across his desk authorizing that, and commented that all senior military leaders, all people that had, it looked like, some political opportunity or potential of winning races under, you know, surveillance. Those are things that have been talked about now for the last 2 years in spades from probably half a dozen different whistleblowers. And I think for us, the importance is there is such an incredible opportunity at this point for us still to push back against that. There are people that are upset about it. There are people that say this isn't right. We believe in the Constitution. But we let this go too long, and we aren't going to have the capacity to fight it anymore. Already, we have an all-knowing government. If it decides to target you, there's nothing that they won't put out about you. They will compromise you based upon what they know. And this is something that's the problem with this idea of a surveillance state that knows everything. It can then selectively use the information in a way to ensure that it continues to get its way and that reformers don't challenge it.
Okay, for Joe Miller in Anchorage, Jim joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Yes, Joe, our government, U.S. government, seems very unwilling to defend our borders against illegal immigration. Both Democrat and Republican parties are dragging their feet. I'm just going to hang up, but what would your solution be? Do you have one? Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. We do have a solution. And in fact, if it's not out today, I think we put out a PR about this morning. I haven't looked at my email recently, but there are a number of things that can be done. But let me talk first just briefly about my position on amnesty and the position on the borders. It's an uncompromising position, but let me give you the human side of it first. My daughter lives in Mexico right now. She serves an international mission, youth with a mission, building homes for underprivileged people in Mexico. She's married to a Mexican national. He wants to become a citizen. He wants to do it the right way. When we have people that come across and get rewarded for doing it the wrong way, it makes, of course, not only does it, I think, undercut the rule of law in this country, but it also, of course, puts people behind that want to do it the right way that are overseas waiting to come in and wanting to contribute to this country. There are some fairly easy things that can be done to prevent this problem. One, you secure the border. That's something that even though there's been laws passed and money allocated, the leadership of both parties don't want it to happen. I was in a debate East Anchorage High several weeks ago with both Mr. Treadwell and Mr. Sullivan. And while there, I asked the audience of about 300 people, how many Republicans in this audience are for amnesty? I got one hand raised, one. And I made the comment, why is it then that your leadership is supporting it? It makes no sense when the vast majority of people say no to this, that the leadership of both parties continue to push for it. And again, it's this nexus between corporate power and government. And they want cheap labor. And their servants in government say yes. But it's destructive to the nation. It's destructive to the rule of law. Other things that can be done, put pressure on the governments that are sending the people to us. And this Central American influx that occurred, we have controls in those countries. We have the ability to impact those countries. I've said this on the ad that's running right now. This is another solution. You cut off foreign aid to the countries that are sending these people to us. Another solution. You, as a result of illegal aliens coming across the border, don't provide benefit. You don't give them a step up. Unlike my opponent, Mead Treadwell, who believes that there should be a pathway to citizenship for some illegals that come here, and Mr. Sullivan, who's funded by pro-amnesty groups, I think we should be uncompromising in that because if you reward it, you're going to encourage more of it. But those are just three things, and there are several other things that we could also do to help stem the flow, but three things that I think would go a long way to shutting this problem down.
Our guest is Joe Miller. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. That was a very clear answer there. Very clear and very definitive.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Let's go to Shelley, joins the program from Delta Junction. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Joe Miller.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, Mr. Miller, You said earlier that you are unequivocally pro-life. Like most Republicans say that they are, they believe that life begins at conception, but their actions say that their support for that life ends at birth. They turn against people who need social services. Many of those people who are you want to force have children they can't support, they need increases in welfare. They need health insurance. They need unemployment increases. They need increase in education. But the Republican Party seems to fight those at every turn. Will you fight those? Will you still fight for that life that begins at conception and continues on after birth, or will you fight against them?
Yeah, that's a good question, Shelley. And it's this nexus between, and let me make this clear. There is a clear distinction between what the federal government and the state government should be doing. And my perspective is that the state governments should have the scope of whatever they want to do with respect to its people that the people authorize. I mean, I think that was the founders' intent. The federal government, you know, it has limited powers. Much of what we see today, and this is, you know, kind of Mark Begich's view, it's kind of President Obama's view, is that we need to expand government. We need to give government more opportunity to interfere in our lives. We should tell the federal government that there's more that it should do. And when we look over the last several decades of federal government action, we can see that at least at the federal level, it's a broken system. It's one that has not helped. It's not one that's helped advance the people.
I don't want to hear about the overextension of the federal government. I'm talking about social services, whether they come from the federal government or the state government. I'm talking about you taking care, help get these life that begins at conception, how you're going to make their life better after birth.
Well, and
what,
again, I'm
what
trying.
What you're going to do through social services, regardless, state level, federal level, whatever. That's a huge issue in this country.
It is a huge issue, Shelley, and I'm trying to answer the question in that I'm running for federal office, not state office. And I think that that is a very appropriate question to be asking both federal and state candidates for office, because currently the federal government is very enmeshed in social services, although most are administered by the state. And my position, even clear back in the 2010 race, has been that the state has the ability to act as broadly as they want according to the people's dictates. But the federal government and what the federal government has done is broken. And the opportunity that I think we should be trying to create at the federal level is creating a free enterprise system that raises all boats, one that creates, you know, the tens of millions of jobs that were created, for example, under the Reagan administration, where wages increased. And it wasn't because minimum wage increased. It was because there was economic opportunity that occurred. When we focus on the country and the needs of this country in eliminating those things that reduce wages, eliminating, for example, the influx of labor from outside our borders that cause wages to stay down, it reduces opportunity. I think at the state level, the state should be permitted to do what its people dictate that it should do in the social services. There are people with real needs, real hurts that the states are better vested to address than the federal government. But the federal government has tried and it's been found wanting. The federal government has failed in what it's doing. And the more that we give the federal government a broken system, the less liberty we have and the more poverty that we're going to have. It has not changed. We've now been fighting the poverty war now since LBJ. And it's still there, and at this point, it's getting worse. And this is with a president that, you know, is singing the tune of the federal government needs to do it all. And yet this president has failed in that effort. And I think, if anything, that shows us that it's the wrong direction to head at the federal level. At the state level, that may be a different story.
Okay.
I'm not running for state office, though.
All right. Thank you. Shelley, there you have it. It's the state's business. He's running for federal office. And thank you for for pressing on your question. Joe Miller is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Joe Miller is our guest on Talk of Alaska. He's running for the U.S. Senate. We've had Mead Treadwell and we've had Dan Sullivan on. It's Joe Miller's turn. So you're behind right now. Let's say you lose a primary. Is that all we'll hear from Joe Miller running for Senate?
Well, I think, first of all, let me address the false premise. Our internal polling shows that there are single digits separating all of the three candidates in the Republican primary. A lot of disinformation with polling. That's what happened last time. You know, and you probably remember one of the polls just a few weeks out from our win in the primary showed us 37 points down. Another by Ivan Moore showed us 32 points down. Even the public polling shows that we're in a much, much better position this time than then. But our internal polling shows single digits. The real issue right now is the significant number of undecided. It's a huge number. And so we expect to win the primary with the effort of our supporters and God's help. But, you know, if we end up winning, one of the things that we're unwilling to do is to make a commitment, even vicariously, through Steve Heimel, as to what we're doing at the conclusion of the primary. Both of my primary opponents supported somebody other than the Republican nominee in 2010, and so there's not a baseline of trust that's been established by which we can make those type of commitments to our opponents. But that being said, we got a solid support base throughout the state. We have had parades all throughout the state. This is anecdotal, beyond the polling data. But we've had by far the largest groups that have been with us there. We've been endorsed by the largest conservative group in the state, the Conservative Patriots Group. We've received more votes than both Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Treadwell combined. The Alaska Republican Assembly endorsed us several weeks ago by a two-thirds vote. Again, a reflection of the grassroots support amongst conservatives. In addition to that, we have other endorsements that don't really reflect the grassroots, but reflect the strength of our positions, which will also help us on Election Day. Gun Owners of America, we're the only endorsed candidate, Larry Pratt's organization, National Association for Gun Rights, and also, of course, Alaska Right to Life. We're the only endorsed candidate from Alaska Right to Life. And so we're excited about that. We're excited about what we're seeing, the open house that we had last night. You know, well over 100 people there, the parking lot packed. I don't think there was a spare slot available for anybody that was coming in. And our launch, similarly, in April, lots of people, lots of grassroots support. People are looking for somebody that they know is not going to go to Washington, D.C. and just get absorbed by the powers. They want somebody that's going to stand up and fight. And they want somebody that knows that the pains and struggles that the people are going through. And Kathleen and I, we've been blessed with many opportunities, but we come from circumstances that are not dissimilar from those of many people. And that's why I appreciated Shelley's comments. And I want to make this clear to Shelley. Of course, she's not on the line anymore. But if you elect me to go to Washington, D.C., the one thing that you can be rest assured of is I am not going to make decisions that hurt the average everyday person. I'm not going to do that. When I talk about getting the federal government out, what I'm talking about is shifting responsibility as well as revenues to the states and let the states decide. But it's not pulling the rug out from anybody, because that's not who I am, and that's not where Kathleen and I come from. We've been there. We understand the pains. The things that we want to do are things that will increase the opportunity, income, and ability of those that we affiliate with. I mean, the people that Kathleen and I count as our friends, our closest friends, are folk that are struggling by on very low wages. Some of them have government programs. These are not people that are from the upper crust. One of my opponents, and I'm not going to call him out by name, told me back in December of 2010 that I had not talked to the right people before running for office. that I had not talked to basically the moneyed class. Now, that sounds a little bit unusual coming from a Republican candidate. I think the Republican Party doesn't have it all right. I certainly don't think the Democratic Party has it all right. I share that opinion with a majority of Americans. The majority of Americans don't believe either party represents them. The majority of Republicans want a new party. And the reason why is they see the system hijacked. There are people that are out there working for interests other than themselves. And even the union member that we talked to from Fairbanks, I'm sure that he's very concerned about the answer I gave. But my ultimate goal is not to serve corporate interests that want to go out there and have amnesty, that want the lowest wage. My ultimate goal is to provide an opportunity to increase wages, to make sure that the middle class can increase its wealth, to make sure that there's opportunity that for those below the middle class to enter into the middle class and enjoy the free enterprise system that at least at one point in this country gave opportunity to all, but now seems to be limiting that opportunity.
You talk about political engagement. There was a huge crowd that showed up for a discussion of the one ballot measure that appears on the primary ballot, which is repealing Senate Bill 21. And you talk about people in fear for their jobs. Everybody I know that works in the energy industry is scared to death of what would happen if that thing would pass. Do you have a position on it?
Again, it's a state issue, and so I hesitate to actually give my position on it because I think people ought to make up their own minds on the issue. But I've publicly said that I'm voting no on it. I've got real concerns on both sides of it, but I don't think that the public ought to willy-nilly go out there and change the tax regime. I'm not saying that the legislature made the right call. I guess we're going to have to wait and see on that. But what ultimately pushed me into the no column was my discussion with the independents. There's been a tremendous amount of production in the Cook Inlet. I remember just several years ago when I studied this up at the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the issue of gas and the fact that Anchorage in a very short term was expected to not have enough. We've completely reversed that. Independents credit that to tax incentives. The independents also, although the ones that I have talked to are not overly excited about the repeal, they all have consistently told me they're supporting a no vote on the prop because they've made plans based upon the tax regime that's been implemented. They've got to have consistency, especially when they're talking about very low margins. And because of that, they want it to remain until there's been a review where we can actually see whether or not it's done what it's intended to do, and that is increase investment, increase jobs, and increase production. But I know that there are arguments on both sides of that issue. That's my position. I think Alaskans need to make the decisions themselves. It's a state issue. Research the issues carefully.
And the other big energy issue, of course, is the gas line, and that's what Jerry in Eagle River wants to talk to you about. Jerry, you're on Talk of Alaska with Joe Miller. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Joe Miller. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Jerry. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, I was born and raised in Fairbanks. I'm a lifetime Alaskan. I'm a construction worker.
Fantastic.
My question is concerning, I know you're in the federal level, but you're still a part of Alaska. So this is my question. The permanent fund dividend, it was never asked of the Alaskan people. It was never put up for vote. Should we have a say-so in building the Trans-Alaska gas pipeline? And I'm sure the most people in Alaska would have pitched in a portion of their permanent fund dividend instead of the state going ahead and putting in their bid for it. How come that was never raised as an issue on a state or a federal level and never brought up to vote?
Boy, Jerry, those are good questions. I mean, I agree that if the state's going to invest in it, the people ought to have a say. I don't believe in, basically government saying we're going to do as we will without oversight by the people. At the federal level, and I know this wasn't exactly your question, but I think there are things that can be done at the federal level to help enhance the likelihood of a gas pipeline actually being constructed. Much of what we see in the permitting process has federal intersect. I mean, you got federal agencies all over the place that can stop it, that can create problems for it, that can increase cost in pipeline construction. And I think as a senator, we can put tremendous pressure on those agencies to do the right thing and to ensure that we can get a pipeline once it starts getting the investments necessary to go forward can be done in a rapid and efficient way without the feds being the slowdown. We see what's happening with the Keystone Pipeline in the lower 48 and how the federal government has been a tremendous blockage to that, even though it would open up incredible opportunity to lower 48 construction and activity in the oil and gas industry. So I think there are things I can do at the federal level. I think at the state level, states investing in it, obviously the people ought to have a say.
Yeah, and my thing is this. A great promoter for that would have been this. Instead of getting a $1,500, $1,300, $900 dividend every year, we would be invested in it, and every quarter, once we started making money, we would get dividends.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there are discussions underway right now. I mean, you got the alternate line, the low-pressure line that is being considered as an alternate if we don't end up with the major line, the pressurized line. And, you know, I think that there is opportunity for state-only options, and I believe that that's being studied. The one thing that is key for me is to make sure that this resource that we have up there on the slope is something that benefits the people of the state. Any solution that we come up with, there has to be something that helps us, you know, Kathleen and I up in Fairbanks. The energy costs that we face right now are extraordinary. I don't know how people make it when they're paying fuel oil costs of over $4 a gallon. You know, we, out of necessity, heat with wood in our house. You can imagine how big it is with one time having 8 kids at our home. And it's an extraordinary undertaking for an average family just to provide heat right now in Fairbanks. And it's, you know, it's atrocious that we're sitting on top of trillions of feet of gas on the slope that is not being brought not just to market, but to the Alaskan people, so that the Alaskan people can have the ability to not break the bank just to heat their homes.
That's a good answer, Joe. I appreciate your concern in there. And any effort you could give to help the Alaskan people, especially exploring economic upturn for the whole community, not only just the living, but the future children of Alaska.
I agree, Jerry. Thanks for your input and your concern.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Plenty more questions for Joe Miller, and not much time for them, but I think I have to bring this one up that comes from Katie and goes back to the abortion issue. Joe Miller, your position is quite clear, but she wants to take issue with it. And she's basically saying, look, you know, on the one hand, you're talking about people in government that want to control your life, but when I try and make a decision about a pregnancy that endangers my health that I'm not ready for, there's government interference. How can you justify that?
Well, I think government is there for a singular purpose, and that is to preserve those fundamental liberties that God has given us and to also ensure that it doesn't infringe on them. I think life is fundamental to those. In my perspective, life starts at conception. If we, as a nation, sit back and say that we aren't going to defend that life, then what else is up for grabs? And I think pretty much everything is. That's my position, unequivocally pro-life. You know, I believe that there are rare circumstances, obviously, where we have a situation where there's endangerment to the health of the mother. And, of course, in those circumstances, we save the life we can. But my position is clear, and you know, I apologize if I have disagreement with Katie on it, but I think the role of government, especially on those issues, it can't create a higher contrast. If we aren't protecting those lives, then what else will government do to infringe on our liberties?
Let's go to Mike, joins the program from Homer. Mike, you're on the air on Talk of Alaska with Joe Miller.
Yeah, hi, Mr. Miller. How are you?
I'm doing well, Mike. Thanks for the call.
Sure, you bet. I'm concerned about your stance on the EPA. In my own feeling, I think the EPA is a worthwhile endeavor by the government because of, just for an example, I've got a cabin across here in Ketchmack Bay, and Aurora Lagoon was used as a gold mining back in the early 1900s, and it's still full of old gold mining equipment. I firmly believe the EPA was in existence today, that would not be there because they would have had to clean it up. Why do you think the EPA was became in existence? What, in your opinion, why do you think that happened?
Well, Mike, I mean, there are a variety of reasons as to why it came into existence. But let me just start first on the gold mine issue. I don't know when the gold mine was constructed, and this is not intended to be a complete defense of the DEC. But it's doubtful that the DEC existed at the time that gold mine was constructed either. And I think right. that my position is, you know, most of us here came to Alaska because we love the great outdoors. We love the beauty of the state. None of us want to see it polluted. None of us want to see people take development and use it for the sole goal of producing as much as they can, damn the consequences to the environment. I think we in Alaska know that better than those even in Washington, D.C. I think it was intended with respect to the environment for states to primarily take the significant role in that area. In other words, DEC should have a greater role than the EPA. And in fact, much of what the EPA requires is effectuated through the DEC anyway. But frankly, with respect to the EPA and getting to your question as to why it's where it's at today, it's because the federal courts have allowed the federal government to go far beyond what the Constitution allowed it to do. Article 1, Section 8 gives the federal government 18 enumerated powers. EPA is not part of that. And I'm not saying that there's no role for the federal government in environmental protection. I'm just saying that, you know, when we're dealing with situations like in Fairbanks, I filed a lawsuit a number of years ago against the Corps of Engineers because the Corps of Engineers said we have federal jurisdiction over a residential lot on which there's permafrost. And the twisted logic that they used to get to that was that, well, because there's permafrost here, sometimes during the year, we have a plant that we classify as a wetlands plant. And because of the temperature and the vegetation, we're going to say that this is a wetland subject to our jurisdiction. I mean, there is no way that somebody could, I think, honestly and reasonably say that the founders ever intended the federal government using that kind of reasoning to have jurisdiction over a homeowner's use of his own lot. Doesn't make any sense to me. Now, if the state decided that there should be permitting or jurisdiction over, that's for the state to decide. The state more subject to its people, local state control. You can go down to your state legislator's office, look them in the eye and say, I don't like this. You need to change that. I want this cleaned up. You shouldn't allow them to do this without good oversight. But at the federal level, you're dealing with a one-size-fits-all, which, frankly, I don't think fits Alaska. And I think much of what it does has been done because of the activism on the Supreme Court.
So would you try to disband the EPA then if you became senator?
I think that there are some things that the EPA does that should continue to be done, but I would prefer the EPA not to do it. There are other federal agencies that can. Much of what the EPA does, it shouldn't be doing. The state should be doing it. And so, frankly, it would be best. There are a number of agencies. The bureaucracy, the power at the federal government, it's not just these legislators and judges that are looking at the federal government as something it shouldn't be, but it's also the bureaucracies themselves that build up over time and through their budgets take on a lot of power. And I really think that the only fix to the EPA is to disband it and give its limited powers that it should be doing over to one of the other agencies.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mike. Let's go to Grant, joins the program from Wasilla. You're on the air with Joe Miller.
Hey, good morning, sir. It's Grant Bryan. I'm actually on leave, active duty Navy, home in Wasilla right now. And I'd be amiss if I didn't say, go Navy, beat Army.
Beat Navy. Grant, my son's home. He just got home night before last. He's a second-year cadet at West Point. And, of course, you know my history, too. But, you know, if you've been watching Army-Navy recently, you'll know that you've gotten the better of us for the last several years.
Yes, sir. I graduated from the Hill Academy and just been getting interested in politics over time. But thank you for your service. And I actually wanted to ask you along those lines, from a senator's perspective, what can you do to change the culture as a leader in the Senate? Primarily looking at the bipartisan sickness that's kind of taken over the Senate. And I feel as though half the country is so divided. Half is on one side, half is on the other, but there's going to be no solutions unless we bridge that gap. And there's a cliche phrase of reaching across the aisle, but honestly, how is it fixed and what can you do to fix it?
Thank you, Grant, and thank you for your service. You know, Ted Cruz, I think, put it best when he said it took a whole lot of bipartisanship to get us to $17 trillion in debt. And since those comments, I think we're at 17.5 now. I think what's important is for, and American people are getting this grant, although it isn't translating into action in Washington, D.C. But the poll that I mentioned earlier in today's program, where a majority of Americans believe that neither party properly represents them, a majority of Republicans want a new party. I think there's an increasing recognition that our government at the federal level has been hijacked by interests other than those for the American people. The important factor is to sound off on that issue until the American people react like they reacted on the Ryan Murray bill, you know, where we ended up with the retirement for military service members that have given decades of service cut, even though, you know, the federal government was growing at the time. They reacted in such a way that it actually changed policy. The more that we talk about how both parties are doing the same thing, hijacking future generations by increasing the debt, being subservient to multinational corporations rather than the people, taking actions that harm the middle class, harm the economic opportunity of the people, and taking decision-making from the states, I think the more opportunity we have to take back the country with actually a nonpartisan effort. Not a Republican or Democrat. Now, you know, one of the things we've been talking about from the beginning of my campaign are those central issues that even the left and the right can agree on. The surveillance state is one. The fact that we've got to do things in order to help the free enterprise system so that all boats can rise. Standing against those things that depress labor, such as illegal aliens, amnesty, such as importing workers. Those things that hurt the national security of the country. The things that we need to do to increase the readiness of the country. Getting out of the foreign entanglements that don't put forward the national interest of the country and the Constitution. There are lots of issues that I think people can join together with in this country outside of party that can get the nation back. And so I think you're headed down the right trail, Grant, and I appreciate the comment.
Liberty. Liberty is the word from Joe Miller, and I'll take this one from Brett in Ketchikan that says, hey, wait a second, you're talking about overreach of the federal government and so forth. How do you justify those statements without sounding hypocritical regarding your views on gay rights?
You know, that's a state issue, and that's the answer to it. That is a state issue, and so that's the lack of hypocrisy. States can determine. Increasingly diverse country, make those decisions at home. Your listeners, if they've got more questions, can go to joeforliberty.com. joeforliberty.com. Pretty well-developed website, has issues, lots of information. There's a contact blank there if you want to ask more questions. Would love to have the input of your listeners. Again, joeforliberty.com.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Joe Miller.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you having us.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll show up again after the primary.
Would love to do it, Steve. Thanks.
All right. Joe Miller's been our guest. I want to thank Dave Waldron and the rest of the crew there on the telephones. And I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. Enroll now for health care benefits. Yukon Kuskokwim Village veterans can enroll at the Veterans Standdown event at Bethel August 1st through 3rd at the Old Armory Killbuck Gym. Learn about VA, state, and community programs, meet with staff, enjoy a free meal, and receive free military surplus gear. Apply early at 543-6705. This message sponsored by the VA. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.